solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
The CEO at the end of the table said, Linda, I have a question for you. I have spent the last 33 years busting my butt to make so that my family and my wife could live like princesses. And you spend a lot of time with these people and particularly with their spouses. And I wonder, do you ever sense any kind of gratitude? Now, if you think about that, Deepak, that is a deeply felt question. It's a hard question to hear. It's coming from a pretty painful place. But Linda was so gracious. She looked at him in the eyes and she smiled and she said, yeah, sometimes I sense gratitude, but very often I sense that they accepted the lifestyle you provided in exchange for the intimacy and the cherishing that they really, really wanted.
Welcome to the 81st Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I end up having conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's www.playtopotential.com. If you've been a regular at the podcast, you will know that one of the themes I'm deeply curious about is this notion of midlife reinvention and renewal. In that context, I came across the book Half Time by Bob Buford a few years back, where he speaks about moving from success to significance. Bob had gone on to set up the Halftime Institute to help several leaders navigate this transition thoughtfully. I'd wanted to speak to Bob on the podcast, but he unfortunately passed away in April 2018. I was thrilled when I was recently reintroduced to the Halftime Institute by an entrepreneur and a member of YPO in India, Rishi Khanna, who was kind enough to introduce me to Lloyd Reeb, who had worked closely with Bob in setting up the Halftime Institute and has been working with thousands of leaders for the last 20 years, helping them transition from success to significance. If I look at all the podcast conversations here over the last 5+ years and force rank them in the decreasing order of insight density, this one would be right up there. I hope you find it as meaningful and nuanced as I did. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Lloyd Reeb. Lloyd, thank you so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to really have you here.
Yeah, great to be with you, Deepak, and see your smiling face. And thanks for all you're doing to serve people. You know, I love the way you're integrating your background and your passions as a way of serving your fellow men and women. You know, it strikes me that they say that strengths are for service, not status. And that's something important that I see in your life.
Thank you, Lloyd. It means a lot coming from you. Just for the purpose of listeners, Lloyd, could we maybe establish a little bit of context if you talk a little bit about a Halftime Institute and your journey and how you got here? Maybe we could pick it up from there.
Absolutely. I'm a real estate developer, which in the United States means that you buy land and design buildings, build buildings, own buildings. And we built and own buildings for elderly people. So in our country, and at least in North America, many elderly people don't live with their family. They choose to live in a group setting where they're provided for. And so we did that over the last 34 years. And in about 25 years ago, I looked up from my desk one day and And I wondered, you know, is there more to life than just building more buildings and growing our net worth? Is there more to life than just accumulating? It struck me that the times I found the most joy was when I was giving, not getting. And it sort of rung true with the ancient wisdom that it's better to give than to get. I remember, Deepak, I took a trip with a friend through Asia. And we went to Hong Kong and we saw the wonderful sights down in downtown Hong Kong. This was in 1990. And then we went to the Philippines and we had a friend working with poor children in the Philippines. And we spent a week just playing basketball with kids that had nothing. And they were looking for their next meal and they had no hope and vision.
Mm.
And we just spent the week with them, loving them, encouraging them, playing basketball, having fun, sharing, you know, God's love and forgiveness with them, inspiring them. And then we went to Malaysia and we sat on a beach at a 5-star resort drinking, I don't know, martinis or something, you know. And I remember thinking, this is not the life I want. I had more fun last week with those kids in the Philippines. And that was a pivotal moment for me to realize that, you know, I had bought into this kind of classic idea that you may have heard of, the American dream, that if you put your head down, get in the best university. I went to McGill University in Montreal. And I got a world-class education. And then I worked with TD Bank and, you know, it looked like, the American dream coming true, only it wasn't nearly as fulfilling as I thought it might be. And so along the way, I started experimenting. Well, how could a real estate developer make a difference outside of real estate? And I found that there are many of the skills that I had cultivated applied in pretty much a wide spectrum of settings. And so along the way, someone introduced me to a gentleman named Bob Buford, who was 22 years older than me. I was in my mid-30s, he was in his late 50s, and he had just written the book Halftime, Changing Your Game Plan from Success to Significance. And so he asked me, well, what if you were to come do a talk with me? Because you're much younger, you're less affluent, but you've built enough wealth to supply your family's needs. I think we could bracket the movement. I'm older and more wealthy, he said, and you're younger and less affluent. So you could speak to those people who have this longing to make a difference, but don't have hundreds of millions of dollars, right? And so that started our journey together. And now that was 1997. So 25 years later, I've spent so many hours helping people from every country. I've spent two big trips traveling through India, speaking to people who have the same longing. And it's brought so much joy to hear their stories.
That's lovely. Lloyd, a couple of things strike me, right? One is, in a way, this podcast, you know, the editors of this podcast come from a community where resources are scarce. So by design, I tell the listeners, if they're seeking value from the podcast, they paid forward to this not-for-profit that works with these children and provides them an opportunity to get education and employment called Antarang Foundation. So that piece, as you said, brings great joy. And I was struck by Bob's book when I read it a few years back. One of the pieces I wanted to pick up on, Lloyd, was, you know, one of the other thinkers in the podcast earlier was a lady called Linda Grattan of London Business School, who's written a book, 100 Year Life. And she says, we're moving from a world where we had established phases, right? You study, work, and retire. Now, and if you knew somebody's age, you knew their stage. But now we're moving to a anytime life kind of a transition. So how do you think about this notion of halftime in the world we're in? And how has that evolved over the last couple of decades you've been doing this?
I think she's right. And perhaps this current pandemic that we're just coming out of is pushing it faster in that direction with so much mobility and our days are sliced and diced, and so our years and decades are sliced and diced. The risk with that is you just become spaghetti. There's no kind of architecture or structure to your life. And so the onus is on each of us to think in terms of being chief life officer if you're going to have to zig and zag and reinvent yourself more than just twice. You know, it used to be you had 20 years of preparation, 30-year career, 30 years of retirement. If you look back even further, the average life expectancy was 48 or 49, just 100 years ago. That was the average life expectancy here in America. So you didn't even have the last 30 years. You basically came to your 50s and you were tired and worn out. You were a manual worker, not a knowledge worker. Your contribution dropped off with your energy dropping off. Today, so many talented, smart people in India, their contribution can continue well into their 80s. And very many of them have global exposure because India is such a global part of the global supply chain. And so it's true that they're going to have endless opportunities going forward. And the more opportunities you face, the more important it is to know who you are, what you care about, why you do what you do, and to have some metrics along the way, and then to revisit that plan. One of the things that Peter Drucker challenged Bob to do early on was to create a life decades exercise. Mm-hmm. And that was to start with the current decade and define it using a single word or two. Now that takes a little bit of difficult thinking, right? To describe the current decade of your life with a single word or two. And then to go back to the decade prior when you were younger and describe it with a single word or two and how you spent your time. And then go back a decade earlier. Pretty soon you're in your teen years. But the power of the exercise is as you look forward and you describe the next decade of your life with a single word or two. And then two decades after that and all the way into your 80s or 90s. And what happens is it starts to provide a trajectory in your mind, and you start to realize that you have agency, you have responsibility to be planning and thinking about the future. So with so many options comes the responsibility to learn both the leadership and the intentionality and the skills to be an effective chief life officer. You can no longer rely on your company to map out your life for you. And chances are, if you come home from your company and you've given it all you've got and you have nothing creative to give to your spouse or your family or your neighbors or your community, that you'll end up largely disappointed in the second half of your life or the next season of your life. So I think she's onto something. You know, it's still important to think about life in terms of a first and half and second half, because there are some fundamental changes that happen as you age. And one is that if you've chosen to have a family, they leave. And they go off to college like you did. You know, imagine the day when you went off to ITT. IIT, yeah, right. And then even further to London Business School, right? Your mom, you know, just think about those days in her life after you'd left, and your dad as well. It created a pivotal moment for them, and the same is true for many people. Now, you and I, if we live till we're 85 or so, you know, between 50 and 60, we'll do some things, and we'll probably want to change that between 60 and 70. And historically, people have moved from warrior to king to sage. And if you think back thousands of years, and, you know, I've seen some of the history and some of those amazing archaeological sites in India, and it takes you back thousands of years, doesn't it? And you see faith interwoven in thousands of years of Indian history, and you realize that these people, they went from warrior to king to sage. And in our lives, the transition from king to sage is the most difficult transition. Because you give up all the perks, you give up the sort of the levers, and you're left with influence if you're lucky. So that's why I agree with her, and I think it puts the onus on you and I to really learn how to be chief life officer.
And maybe just picking up from that, Lloyd, the term chief life officer, it'll be good to spend a couple of minutes and flesh that out. As you look at leaders, especially kings, you know, to use your metaphor, people that have achieved a certain level of success, have power, What elements of life do they often end up missing out on when you look at the range of leaders that you spend time with?
Well, you know, very often it's the softer, what you would call the softer side of life. The cultivation of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
The ability, for example, to have an intimate relationship with friends or with their spouse or with their children very often gets truncated because of busyness and the pace that they go and not being available very often. Their spiritual development, if they're coming from a faith perspective,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it gets truncated. Sometimes their own personal development moves, you know, towards hubris or towards arrogance. And you never end up with a rich and fulfilling life if you become more and more arrogant or hubris. People don't even enjoy being around you. And so you can see that sneaks up on people. And then sometimes their spouse, if they're ignored, they accept a lifestyle in exchange for the intimacy that they really wanted. I was speaking at a YPO event, Young President's Organization. They have chapters all throughout India. If you're a CEO of a company or president of a company below the age 40, you can qualify to apply for being a part of the YPO. Mm. And you probably know them, right? Right.
Yes. Some of them, yeah.
And so this was a dinner of 9 CEOs. It was a weekend retreat that I was leading with them. And I always bring my wife, Linda, to those. Mm-hmm. And they wonder, why do you bring your wife? Well, first of all, I like being with her. And they're a little bit surprised at that. And then I know that they will want her advice sooner or later. And sure enough, this particular night, they said to me, "Do you think Linda would join us for dinner if we asked her nicely?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes. And so she came. And so imagine this. It's on a piazza overlooking the golf course, the 18th hole. And there's mm-hmm. 9 CEOs with gray hair and blue suit jackets. And I mean, pretty intimidating for Linda. But she came along and we sat down in this beautiful glass conference room overlooking the golf course as the sun was setting.
Mm-hmm.
And she picked up her fork to dig into her meal. And the CEO at the end of the table said, "Linda, I have a question for you. I have spent the last 33 years busting my butt so that my family and my wife could live like princesses.
Hmm.
And you spend a lot of time with these people and particularly with their spouses. And I wonder, do you ever sense any kind of gratitude?" Now, if you think about that, Deepak, that is a deeply felt question. It's a hard question to hear. It's coming from a pretty painful place. But Linda was so gracious. She looked him in the eyes and she smiled and she said, "Yeah, sometimes I sense gratitude, but very often I sense that they accepted the lifestyle you provided in exchange for the intimacy and the cherishing that they really, really wanted."
Hmm.
So one of the things we give up is what's priceless. So one of the exercises to do is to make 2 lists on 1 sheet of paper. On the right side, write down everything you have that's valuable. It's buildings, it's properties, it's stocks, it's car, maybe it's a house, maybe who knows what you have. On the left side, write down everything you have that's priceless. And then ask yourself, what am I doing to protect the priceless things? Now, when I did that first, my mentor, Bob Buford, encouraged me to do it, asked me to do it. I found that many of the things that were in the priceless category were completely unprotected.
Hmm.
I wasn't paying attention to my health because I was so focused on making money. I wasn't really deeply investing in my marriage. I could do a better job understanding my children's strengths and learning style and love language. And so you know, my reputation was largely unprotected, but it's priceless to me. And I went back and I worked on protecting the things that are priceless. So if you're in your first half and you're on an all-out quest for wealth, my encouragement to you is work hard, do what you love, and wealth will come along. But don't ever trade something that's priceless for something that's merely valuable.
It's profound.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I guess MasterCard used his insight when it came up with the line, there are some things money can't buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard. The way I see it, the challenge in bringing it to life is that for valuable items, it's very easy to put them on a scorecard for yourself and for others. And then the whole you manage what you measure takes over and you drive it. The priceless often is the small intangibles that are often hard to put on a scorecard. One frame that I find helpful is that we often make lists of what we do and what we own. Priceless moments are often in the realm of being. Being a good father, being a compassionate human being a caring husband, and so on. I guess one crucial element is for us to raise our awareness and slowly gravitate towards being metrics and not just doing or owning metrics as we go through our journey. In the work I do, I realize that it's critical for me to engage with a person as a whole. If I can't help a leader being an effective chief life officer in his journey or her journey, it's no significant use me trying to help him or her being an effective executive at work. I try and keep that front and center when I engage with the people I work with. If this topic is of interest, you might like the playlist Views on Success and Work and Life. You can find them at playtopotential.com in the curated playlist section. Let's now get back to the conversation with Lloyd Reeb. And going back to your journey, Lloyd, you talk about hitting the pause button in 1993 when I read your book. Talk to us a little bit about how leaders can build that pause in their life as they, you know, approach that sort of phase of life. What have you discovered about building that pause for people to take stock?
Yeah, great. It's not easy to do, right? Because our lives are busy. But if you look at if you ever watch the Olympics and you watch the swimmers, it's interesting that every swimmer swims hard into the pool wall, and then they do a flip turn, and they push off the wall to start the next lap, and as they push off the wall, they take a glide. And they don't take the glide because they're lazy, and they don't take the glide because they're tired. They take the glide because that's how you win. And it's important to go through the water as smoothly and as fast as you can, and that's one way to do it. So the same is true with transitions in life. When you sense that there's a transition, a new season is coming, then it's important to take some time to pause and reflect as opposed to just work on the solution. One of the most common mistakes that managers and executives make when they begin a transition in their life is they work on the solution too quickly. Now, we would never do that in our business. We wouldn't start naming a product or working on advertising. We start with who's the customer? What does the customer consider value? What is our value proposition as a result of that? What is our strategy? We work through all of these things before we name the product and we come up with creative advertising. So, you know, when you're in transition, the temptation is to start to ask the question, what will I do next? And it's the wrong question. You have to start with some inside questions. Who am I? What am I good at? What do I care about? What are my long-term desired results, or what are my long-term metrics? And so when you think about being chief life officer, it's about knowing the long-term metrics in your life. It's about knowing your role and your mission. It's about allocating, investing your time, not just spending your time. These are all things that chief investment officers do inside a company, right? You don't just give your time away. You don't just give your capital away. You invest your capital. So So invest your time based on your long-term metrics. And so I would say that, you know, the key thing is to in a pause, is to create some daily time of silence and solitude, some weekly Sabbath time where you take time. You know, what strategic coach teaches is you have focus days, buffer days, and off days. And when they coach executives, they tell them the most important days are the off days. You need to count them. So if you don't have any off days, you can't reflect. You know, it's interesting that the chief of staff for Bill Clinton convinced him to take 2 hours every day with no meeting scheduled just to think. Now, if the president of the United States can take 2 hours every day just to think, I think you can do that. So then to take a more extended time every year, what I do is a silent spiritual retreat day, three days a year, three separate times a year. Uh-huh. I take a day alone that I'm silent. And it's a time of reflection and thinking. And I come back to my plan. And so now if you're in transition,
do you travel somewhere to do that, Lloyd, or do you do that at home?
Yeah, no, I don't do it at home, Deepak, because there's so many distractions. There's, you know, something needs cleaning, something needs mowing or whatever, or fixing. I go someplace that's beautiful, it's quiet. Yeah, do you do that a bit in your life? Do you take some time to think?
Not in as structured a way as you do, Lloyd, but I do like to sort of have do nothing days, right? Where you just, but I haven't tried complete silence. One of the things on my list is there's something called Vipassana meditation, where you go on a silence retreat for about 12, 13 days. It's been on my to-do list. I haven't gone there yet.
Yeah. And that's probably good for our listeners to hear, is that, you know, it's good to have these aspirational goals and work towards them. And you may not get there 12, 13 days right off the bat, but you might be able to do one, two full days. Mm. I found my first silent day drove me crazy. You know, I just wasn't accomplishing anything. Everybody's getting ahead of me. And finally, after a few of those, I learned that I actually am accomplishing something much more than I ever dreamt. And without doing it, I'm sacrificing. Now, if some of your listeners, Deepak, have a transition where they have the luxury of taking more time for a glide, for a pause, you need to structure the time. You can't just sit and stick and stare at your tummy, you know, for 3 weeks. You have to structure the time or you won't do well with it. So you want to work through a process. This is what the Halftime Institute does, is it creates a process for people to work with peers to gain clarity. And you want to think about it this way: get clear, get free, and get going. You don't want to get going first, because you could be going in the wrong direction. And nothing worse than running really, really fast in the wrong direction. You get clear, and then you get free, and then you get going. Now, the clear part is, who am I? What am I passionate about? What's my purpose in life? What are my long-term metrics? That's clarity. The get free is getting rid of the clutter in your life, those good things that are the enemy of the best. My wife and I just spent 3 weeks in Germany because our middle daughter got married, and she married a German. And so
congratulations.
The wedding was, thank you, it was there. And so we said to ourselves, in the interest of simplicity, let us just take a backpack each, no suitcase. And we will only take public transit, no Ubers, no limos, no rented cars. So we each took a 13-pound backpack. Now, she was going to be the mother of the bride. Think about that. If you're the mother of the bride and you're traveling in jeans with a 13-pound backpack, well, it was so freeing.
And how did did your daughter have an opinion on this?
Well, my wife didn't wear the jeans. She borrowed a friend's dress in Germany, and she looked beautiful.
Lovely.
Isn't that funny? And simplicity forced us to be more creative. And what happened is she borrowed the dress from the bridegroom's mom. And wow. It turned out to be a wonderful bond between those two women.
Hmm.
You see, it forced us to be more creative. And so, you know, we went all around Berlin on little scooters that you rent, that you get, like, you know, like with your app for like
right.
20 cents
right.
a minute.
Got it.
It was such an adventure and so freeing. So that's what it is to get free. There's a song that says you can't imagine the freedom you find from the things you leave behind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who's this by, out of curiosity?
Michael Card. Michael Card. You can't imagine the freedom you find from the things you leave behind. So very often at midlife, things like lifestyle and toys and cars and club memberships and even friends that are dragging us down, sometimes there are necessary endings, right?
Moving forward, Lloyd, you talk about how we think about three T's, right? Time, talent, and treasure, to discover the greatest possible impact one can make. And in my experience of working with a few leaders, and this is often a struggle, right? A, discovering what's, you know, how should I think about talent? You know, there are different ways to frame it. The world, you know, labels you in a few ways, but there is a broader way of thinking about it. And also, what's the greatest possible impact? There are multiple possibilities. So can you give us some directional guidance on how leaders should think about this?
Well, first of all, I think it's the most important thing is your attitude. To view what you have as not an owner, but as a steward.
Hmm.
You know, everything I have will someday be given away. I have some classic cars that I love. There will come a time when I hand the keys over. So I'm a steward of it. And I'm not going to spend everything I have on me. It would be a miserable life. So I have to think about my life with an open hands and say, I've been given time, talent, and treasure. Now, my responsibility is to figure out how I combine those creatively to make the maximum contribution. So the place you want to start first is, what do I want at the end of the day? What are my desires? And you know, you wouldn't start a business without having clear long-term metrics. You've worked at McKinsey Consulting. You guys are the experts at this, helping clients build long-term metrics, right? That drive all of their key performance indicators and systems and processes towards those metrics. So before you can figure out your best contribution, you have to ask yourself this question. If my life turned out perfectly, what would the elements be?
Hmm.
Now, that's a balance sheet question, not an income statement question. It's envision yourself, let's say 30 years from now, Deepak, I would be 89. My birthday is on Saturday. I turned 60 on Saturday. So,
wow. Congratulations in advance.
Yeah, so that's why your audience can't see how much gray hair I have, can they? And so I would be 89 if we met 30 years from now. And suppose I looked over at you and I said, Deepak, it's so wonderful to see you. Your smile is just as nice as it was when you 30 years ago. But tell me, how did it go for you? And suppose you look out the window and you look me back in the eyes and you say to me, Lloyd, you're not going to believe it. It actually went perfectly. What would be those factors you'd have to scroll through in the back of your mind in order to draw that conclusion? If mm-hmm. you can answer that, then it's relatively easy to figure out how to deploy your time, talent, and treasure to maximum impact. If you can't answer that, then it's hard to build a strategy. You become tactics in search of a strategy. Now, in terms of your question about time, talent, and treasure, so the talent piece is a combination of your expertise, your experiences, the natural gifting that you have, your relational strengths. And so you want to look at it from several different angles. If it were me, I would go do a strength assessment, such as the Gallup Strength Finders assessment. I would ask my team, tell me, what are the one or two most valuable things I do to help our team be successful? And then I would I'd ask my family, you know, what do you think I'm best at? What do I do for our family that's really extraordinary? Ask your closest friends, and then, you know, write out your expertise, and then sit and list your experiences. So, for example, your experience at McKinsey tells me a lot about your analytical skills. Way back when, the managing partner of McKinsey's in Manhattan was on the board of the Halftime Institute with me. His name was, let me just try to find it now in my head. I will remember it. But when he died, I read a quarter of a page obituary in the Financial Times international version. I was in the Hong Kong airport. And it described that his biggest contribution to McKinsey's was to convince them to hire scientists and engineers as opposed to just MBAs. And he himself had a PhD in physics. And so I know something about your background and your expertise just by your pedigree, right? And so you bring that McKinsey thinking with you everywhere you go. And so that's part of your treasure. Now, what you want to be able to do is you need to be able to synthesize it down into a few words. You can't sit down with somebody and say, suppose it's a new team that you're going to contribute to. You're going to help lead a team. You can't just tell them, 35 minutes about your strengths and expertise. You have to summarize it. So for me, I'm a thought leader. You know, that is my background. That's my strengths. My strengths in the Gallup Strength Finder are strategist, futurist, activator, belief, and focus. The strategist, futurist, and activator are all forward thinking. Now, that makes me a good thought leader, but a really bad manager, a bad operational leader. And so as a result, I stay out of every operational role I can possibly stay out of. But I am good at helping people think through complex things in their life. So that lets me say what I would call a smiling no.
Got it. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Of the three, time, talent, and treasures, I noticed that it's very easy for us to notice and observe time and treasures. It's the talent part which is often nebulous and hard for people to get their head around. Lloyd speaks about tools such as StrengthsFinder to get some insights here. When I'm working with a leader, I find speaking to some of the key people around the leader, friends, spouse, sibling, child, customers, investors, board members, and so on, extremely revealing. One question I often ask is, when does this person come alive? And the answers to that often open fascinating possibilities. One of my earlier guests at the podcast, Professor Dan Cable of London Business School, speaks about an exercise where we assemble together our highlights reel from our life, almost like how we would have a sports highlights package from a game of cricket or tennis. He suggests that we ask the people we've interacted with and piece this together.
And basically what that is, it is memories and stories from family, from friends, from colleagues, from mentors. It's people that have watched you over the years, even over the decades, and then they write a story that is their memory of a time you've done something exceptional. That's the name of the book. That's why that book is called Exceptional. It's, there are times when you've had an extraordinary impact, and here's my memory of you doing that. And I just can't tell you, number one, how powerful and emotional that is to read it from other people as opposed to just self-reflecting. So that's one thing. I think a second thing I'd put out there is just the vast amount of new insights that you can get, because a lot of things that people remember for 15 years, 20 years, and they write down in a lot of detail, you might not even think of as a big deal. You might think, oh, no, that's just easy. That's what anybody would do. And if you have 7, 8, 9 people writing different stories, but around that same theme, but you yourself just don't think that's a big deal, that highlight reel starts to unveil ways of you becoming exceptional. And I call them high leverage moves. It's just a way that you can do a little more in an area and create a much bigger impact, but you wouldn't do it because you kind of downplay it. You think anybody would do it.
If there's one thing I've realized, the second half of life is all about leaning into contexts that make us exceptional and putting ourselves in those kinds of situations rather than plugging our weaknesses in a context that's structurally not suited to maximizing our talents and aptitude. If this is of interest, please look up my conversation with Dan Cable and Tasha Urich, who speaks about the benefit of outside-in perspective. You might also like the playlist Navigational Principles, where several leaders speak about how they move from one orbit to another. Just go to playtopotential.com and check out the curated playlist section. If you're finding this podcast of value, do take a moment to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Do also consider subscribing to our weekly extracts on WhatsApp by sending a message to +91 85914 52129, where we share a short 2-minute extract from the podcast to provoke reflection as you go through your busy life. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Lloyd Reeb. I wanted to go back to one of the things you said, Lloyd, a few minutes back, balance sheet versus P&L. As we think about our lives, can you throw some light on what you would classify as a balance sheet item versus a P&L item? As if we looked at life from perspective of a chief life officer, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, so often we set goals, let's say 1-year goals, or January 1st rolls around and we sit down on January 2nd and we write out some goals for the year. And we keep track of those. So how much money did I earn? How much travel did I do? How much did I accumulate in terms of furniture or housing or wine? I sat beside a guy at a halftime event in Hong Kong, and he told me that year he'd bought $65,000 worth of cigars. I mean, that's an income statement. You know, that comes in and goes out. And a balance sheet question is, what do you have at any one moment in time? And what you want to think about is the end of your life. What is it all adding up to? Peter Drucker, when we would talk about people's roadmaps or people's plans for the next year as they transitioned in halftime, his question was, to what end? To what end? Where is this taking you? What is it that you want at the end of the day? So, for example, for me, I want to have become someone who gives liberally. That's a balance sheet. That's a transformation of my insides so that every person I lock eyes with, I am generous with. Not just my money, but my heart and my time. See, that's a balance sheet. I want to have made a leveraged 100x impact as a thought leader. So in other words, I want to have invested every day, every year of my life in a way that produces, every unit of effort produces 100 units of benefit to other people. So imagine if that was true over the next 30 years, the compounding benefit to other people. If every unit of my effort produced 100 units of benefit in other people's lives. And think about the friendships that would come from that. Think about the joy as I rehearse the stories. I remember helping a guy in Singapore who wrote out a mission statement that he wanted to use his affluence and his influence to help heal the blind. And I remember looking at his mission statement on a flip chart and saying, seriously? I mean, nobody can fix the, I mean, how are you going to fix the blind? Only Jesus was able to spit on a guy's, you know, mud and make mud and put it on a guy's eye. And I went back just before COVID hit, and lo and behold, he had organized and funded 25,000 cataract surgeries for seniors in China.
Wow.
and they can see their grandchildren.
Hmm.
Now, you imagine how much joy I experienced seeing that. So this is what, that's a balance sheet thing. That doesn't go away. I keep, Deepak, I keep something called a book of days.
Mm-hmm.
I keep an artifact every day of my life of someone's life I benefited. So I just, before I picked up the phone to talk to you, I just put a little card in my book of days that came in the mail today from a friend of mine whose mom died. And last Thursday, I cooked their family a meal of barbecued pork chops. And I took it over with bread and it's just everything they'd need. And actually was enough for two or three meals. And it wasn't very difficult. I did it during the day while I was still working. It was cooking and I was working. And I got it in my little car and I took it over there and I knocked on the front door and I gave it to them and I got my car and came home. Well, I got the wonderful card. I stuck it in there. And you know what? 10 years from now, I'll look at that. It's not going anywhere. It's a memory. It's a balance sheet item. Whereas the brand new car I bought in 1987 that I was so excited with, you know where it is? It's in the trash. It's in a landfill somewhere. I don't know where it is, but it's not around here. It's gone. It was an income statement thing, right? So the in some sense, the things that are seen are eternal, and the things that are not seen are temporary.
Hmm.
Or rather, the other way around. The things that are seen are temporary, and the things that are not seen are eternal.
Hmm. And back to what you said, Lloyd, you know, when leaders are transitioning from success to significance, as you say, one of the things I notice is when you're in a corporate track or when you're in a business, the metrics are often visible and measurable. So it gives you a sense of progress and it's easy to calibrate on how you're doing. And when you start moving the needle on significance, often one can start wondering, am I really making a dent? What's been your experience in helping people sort of keep track of impact, especially people that are goal-oriented that have been successful because of that?
Yeah, that's good. So I think first of all is to get an answer to this question. If your life turned out perfectly, what would the elements be? Those are long-term metrics. Now, I keep them in my wallet, and I reference them regularly. There's six metrics, and one of them is to keep in top shape. One of them is to spend my life surrounded by beauty.
Hmm.
One of them is to worship God every day. Now, I can measure that. You know, I either worship God or I didn't worship God today, right? It's a thumbs up, thumbs down, easy to measure. That's the first line of attack, is to know what you want long term, measure it and keep track of it, because it's like a plumb line that a mason uses to build a wall. It keeps you on track. Now, the second thing is that you can measure when you start serving people or making a difference. You can use a business platform, by the way, Deepak, to make a huge impact in people's lives. It doesn't have to be nonprofit. I remember a guy that has a knitting business with 24,000 employees in the Southwest India, and he has affordable housing for them. He's created a grocery store that if they have that little card that acknowledges that they're below the poverty level, they can get everything they need for a family of five for a very small amount of money. And I've gone to his grocery store.
Hmm.
Now, you could try to measure how much joy or satisfaction it brought to your 24,000 employees. Or you can measure the food that you give out at with no profit, right? It's a no-profit grocery store. He just buys and sells to them at his cost so that his employees can have housing and the lifestyle that he wants them to have and still compete in a global market for shirts. Like he knits shirts like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can measure inputs and not only outputs. How much time did you invest? How many children did you mentor? Mm-hmm. How many children did you tutor in reading skills? Now, you can also try to measure the outcomes, but like you say, it's harder to measure the transformation. And sometimes there's a long gestation period. In other words, it could take 15 years to see if that kid does well. and actually breaks out of poverty. And maybe one in 20 breaks out of poverty, but maybe that one becomes the CEO of a big company and serves thousands, creates thousands of jobs, right?
Got it.
So you have to figure out a way that fits your soul where you measure your effort, you measure some results, and then you keep stories. I keep these stories because they're a form of soft measurement.
The other term you use, which caught my attention, Lloyd, was you mentioned that people often approach midlife with their passion, talent, smoldering under wet blankets. And you also go on to say that the passion that fires a success in the first half of life can also be the fire that destroys our health and our relationships. Can you say more here?
Yeah, now this is an area of science, and you might enjoy this because you're a scientist and at heart. That is what I have believed for a long time, that your passions are buried under blankets of busyness, obligation, and responsibility, and that if I could lift the corner and blow oxygen in, they would ignite. And so what I've been doing recently is studying the science of how interest forms. For example, there's a big compilation of social science recently done called The Science of Interest. It's a $100 book. It's very, it's like reading one PhD thesis after another. And so I've been studying that. And I think this is an area where I think I was partially wrong, Deepak.
Mm-hmm.
And let me share with you what I've been learning about how passion forms. So let's say that one of your listeners is in a place where they've got an opportunity to transition. Or they have some extra time because something's changed in their life and they've got 40 hours of work at work and then they've got 10, 15 hours of free time that they could do something new and they want to make a difference, right? And so let's just say that they're looking for what their passion is. And so here's what I've been learning, and I'll just read to you some things that I think may be helpful. Many halftime clients or many people who come to halftime have not been exposed to a wide variety of human experiences or causes. And as a result, they have not tasted the pain of those issues, nor the joy of those who are helping assuage the pain. So it's true that for some people, they might have been abused by a spouse and they're passionate about domestic violence. They might have grown up with as an orphan, and they may be passionate about orphanage. Maybe they were very sick as a child and they're passionate about that. Maybe they saw their father lose a lot of money as an entrepreneur and they want to help entrepreneurs, something like that. That happens sometimes. But more often than not, what happens is that this published compilation, The Science of Interest, suggests that people gain interest through stages. They get clear on their passion through stages. From exposure to knowledge about it to confidence around a particular topic. And then they move into a passion as they engage with the topic and experience joy. And then this new interest becomes part of their identity. And it becomes a passion that they are self-motivated to engage in. So let me tell it to you in a story form for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose a parent notices a child's interest in taking nature photos. So they buy the child a cheap camera. The child takes a few photos. Some turn out, but many do not. And the family celebrates the ones that do turn out beautifully. And the parent points the child to some YouTube videos to learn more about photography. Soon they begin to capture better photos. The parents buy them a better camera. And the family experiences them coming in with great pictures and they start to celebrate them and the person feels the joy of their family seeing their beautiful pictures. And then as a result, they gain confidence in it. Next thing you know, they notice the child is out when it's hot or when it's raining, taking pictures, and they're self-motivated to do it. And eventually, they begin to hear the child telling people that he's a photographer. And it becomes part of his identity. So part of what you need to do if you're looking for your passion is look past at what's happened in your past. Was there a painful experience? But then excuse me, also explore.
Hmm.
Explore a wide variety of things through photos, through stories, through case studies, Google searches. Do an urban plunge where you go downtown and see what's happening. And I remember driving through New Delhi with a driver that was driving too fast because we were trying to get to see a congressman or a parliamentarian, right, in New Delhi, and hit a dog. And the dog was on the ground yelping behind us. And the driver didn't even look back. The driver didn't feel any compassion. And it made me sad. And I wondered, does that happen all the time? Do people and children and dogs get just hit by things? And if so, you know, what could you do about that? Now, that was an experience for me, right? It obviously moved me because I remember it was 3 years ago. I still remember it today. That might be the start of a passion, would be to bring more compassion to animals or to children in some poor parts of New Delhi.
It's an interesting point you make, Lloyd. Sorry.
Yep.
I was just wondering, you know, we talk about something like a liberal arts education after, you know, school, just to expose students to a wide variety of perspectives. I just wonder, sort of, if I take a parallel to that, when we hit midlife, maybe there's an opportunity to widen the aperture and sort of, as you say, experience different things and not just do it cognitively, but also do it experientially. Any perspectives there on gaining experience, not just cognition?
Yeah, that's really important. And so I would think of it in these four ways, explore, learn, assess, and share. So explore a wide variety of things, even if it's just reading about them. Get a global newspaper and read it every day. And ask yourself, what makes me mad, sad, or glad? And go online and go to like master classes or something and take a class in a wide variety of classes or Coursera. Or go to TED Talks and search on disadvantaged children, learning opportunities, the social gap, medical issues you care about, mental wellness, for example, and explore. I remember coaching some Brad Rex, who was the CEO of the Epcot Center in Disney World in Orlando for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, 10 years as a CEO of a big chunk of Disney, you become a customer experience expert. I mean, they are the best in America at the customer experience. And so when he came through halftime, he decided he wanted to find the worst customer experience in America and fix it. And he's working on mental wellness. He found that many working poor people, if they're having a panic attack, they can't take off work to go to a mental wellness doctor to get the medicine they need so that they're functioning properly to take care of their three children. And so he created eHome counseling, which is an online, affordable mental wellness care center, so that any Walmart employee can go to the break room and have a private conversation with a mental counselor, a mental therapist, and get the medicines they need or get the help they need without having to leave work and miss pay and get fired or anything like that. And so he went searching, he went exploring for the worst customer experience in America. And then that's what he found. The learning part is to define a step-by-step process that helps you learn more about that cause. Now, that could be as simple as talking to someone who's the executive director of a literacy program, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then you'd learn about literacy. And then assess it. In other words, you go down, you try it for a day, you come back, and you ask yourself at a heart level, was that fun? Was I good at it? Could I fit it into my lifestyle? Can I make a meaningful contribution? And then the last is you start to talk about it. And as you talk about it, It's thinking your confusion out loud. And it begins to shape your identity. It's talking your way into a new identity.
Hmm. The other piece you talk about, Lloyd, is pursuing success with significance in mind. I found that intriguing. Not to treat these as binary, to say I'll first get success out of the way, then I'll start focusing on significance, but really blending the two in a meaningful way. So can you talk a little bit about that piece of insight?
Yeah, sometimes when you think about life with too big, like binary, like you say, big, huge jumps, you never actually get started. And very often, you can make a huge impact on the current platform you're working on. If you're a teacher, if you're a dentist, if you're a principal, if you're a real estate developer, I mean, think about it this way. We take care of a lot of seniors every day. Why can't I make it more significant? Why couldn't we care more deeply? I'm coaching a guy that runs the third largest chicken business in America. Mm-hmm. They have 10,000 employees. And he has a deep desire to create systems that really help their employees thrive, not just produce the right number of chickens. And actually, it would probably be a good business strategy because he's going to have higher retention rates. Healthier people, better families. So you want to ask yourself the question, how can I infuse meaning and purpose into my life right now where I am? Now, it may be in your current business platform or business or profession, or it may be alongside of it. But you don't have to get rich in order to move from success to significance. It's more a change of heart than a change of job.
The other theme you talk about, Lloyd, is, define the position you best play in a team. Can you say more about that? One of the things I notice often is people zero in on a cause that moves them, but often wonder what's the play here? Should I be an investor? Should I be an operator? Should I be a guide? Or should I just contribute time? What's been your reflection around figuring out the role in the team?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's an important thing. So you don't just default to whatever role the nonprofit or the organization asks you to play, because they're not necessarily skilled at knowing where you fit in. And they're most likely to put you in a role that is their highest pain area. And so they might ask you to raise money and it may not fit your skills. Or they may ask you to be an outside spokesperson and you may be shy and introverted. And so it's up to you to tell them, these are my strengths. Now, when you craft a mission statement, your mission statement should include three things: what you do at your best, what you care the most about, and the difference you want to make in the world. And so the place to start when you're looking for your best role is to share your mission statement, even if it's rough, even if it's too many words, it really doesn't matter. But because it gives the organization that you're working on finding a good role, it gives them a sense of who you are, what you care about. So now, in terms of roles that we've seen people play, let me just kind of run through some of them that are classics. The first one is a board role, but frankly, very few people's best contribution is in a board role. Another common one is as a giver, giving money, being what we call a donor. Now, you can make a big impact as a donor or as an investor, but you probably have to add your skills to the money. You probably want to ask tough questions. Don't just write checks, but be engaged. Ask them, what are you going to do with it? What are the results? How are you going to measure it? How are you going to report back to me? Don't make big, long commitments without, saying, okay, every month I need to see results, or every 6 months I need to see results, or funding based on results, right? That's wise donor. But now let's think of a wide variety of other roles you could play. Let's suppose you're a lean manufacturing expert. If you are an expert at lean manufacturing or Six Sigma, believe it or not, almost every nonprofit, every compassionate ministry needs that help. They need systematic ways to continuously improve. And so I have two guys right now that are helping JARS, Jungle Aviation Research. It's the supply chain to foreign mission agencies that bring the Christian faith message to other countries. And they are using their supply chain expertise from big corporate experience that they had over long careers to help them get better at their work in supply chaining, development and relief to the most remote areas of Nepal and in Africa, etc. So that's an expert role. You know, another way to look at is as a silent partner. You know, very often executive directors, they have no safe person to talk with. Their board, they feel like they can't be open with their board. They can't be open with their staff because they would discourage their staff of the things they're wrestling with. So they suffer in silence. Imagine if you were a silent partner and you just were one of those safe people that was under a signed confidentiality agreement that they could talk their confusion out loud and you could help them. I mean, Deepak, you'd be great at this, right? Because of all your years as a consultant.
A trusted sounding board kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. A sounding board. Or maybe you're a project leader. Or maybe you take a staff role. You know, those are all different kinds of roles. And maybe you're an ambassador, you're a rainmaker, right? And you're out front telling the story. So you want to just look across the whole spectrum and ask yourself, what are the current functions that they need help with that fit my strengths?
Right. One of the things you talk about is managing your finances with an eternal mindset. And you say that it's different from managing them with the goal of getting the most pleasure out of them. Can you say more about the mindset shift here?
Yeah. Now, Deepak, that's really dependent on your, what I would call your worldview. And this is where I want to be really sensitive to our listeners, right? Our listeners are coming from different faith perspectives. Some are coming from a Hindu perspective. Some are coming from a Christian perspective, some Buddhist, some no faith perspective, perhaps. And that statement is written from the perspective of a Christian who is thinking that you know, this life is fairly short and eternity is forever, and that God is personal and he's kind and loving and forgiving, but that we have the opportunity to be his hands and feet, the great healer in this world, and bring compassion. And so as a result, if that's true, then I want to use my resources in a way that are going to bless other people, because it, not only out of gratitude for God's kindness and forgiveness to me, but also because it will reap great rewards in heaven, right? So it's a mix of loving people like you love yourself, which is living out the Christian faith, and also being good steward of the stuff we have, because it's not mine, it belongs to God, and I'm just a steward of it. Recognizing that life is short, eternity is very, very, very long. Now, if you're coming from a different worldview, you may think differently about that. And so that comment was really designed for people who are coming from that who are Jesus followers, you know, who are thinking about life from that heaven and eternal perspective, as opposed to reincarnation or something like that. How would you respond to that though, Deepak? Because you have a broad, you know, I've studied all the faiths in India, but many of them. But tell me, how would you react to that and put it in a way that's going to best serve all of your listeners?
Sure. And there's something that came up in a different conversation as well. And as I reflect on it, the way I think about it, Lloyd, is a bit like, to use business language, it's a bit like debt on a balance sheet. You know, too much debt comes in the way of flexibility and adaptability. And, you know, a high expense lifestyle I see as a little bit of a debt. So the way I sort of think about it is, if we can keep it light and keep it as simple and declutter as much as we can, it just gives us more flexibility and agility. Somehow I hadn't processed it from a religious frame, but that's how I processed it for myself.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I completely agree with that. You know, back to that comment, you can't imagine the freedom you find from the things you leave behind. You know, I asked myself after, a big crisis that happened in 07, 08, I said to myself, you know, this is not the last global crisis. So how can I position myself to make the biggest contribution in the darkest hour? I spent a lot of time thinking about it, Deepak. I wrote down all my thoughts on one sheet of paper, but one of them was to keep my center of gravity low. And that's what you're talking about. Have you ever seen like IndyCar racing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the car is so low that it can go around corners and it's just so agile. And this is what we were doing on that trip in Germany, right? We didn't have bags and everything. We had one little bag. I want to go through life like that, don't you?
It's a beautiful metaphor. I hadn't connected the two. Yeah.
You're light and agile and you can zig and zag and you know, be optimistic instead of dragged down by all this crap and corruption we're carrying with us.
Keep the center of gravity low. I'm going to remember that. Maybe just to share a story here, one of the guests I had spoken to on the podcast was a gentleman called Nandan Nilekani. He's the pioneer of the equivalent of the social security system, if you will, in India, a sort of the unique ID project. He was the CEO of this multi-billion dollar tech giant called Infosys, which competes with the likes of IBM and so on. And he sort of quit that and he joined this project with the government of India with, you know, a startup with no employee. So he was running tens of thousands of people, billions of dollars to a project in the government. And I asked him, you know, what made it possible for you to move from this sort of corner office overlooking a golf course to this? And he said, I come from a small town in tier two India. And, you know, if I really strip all this away, who I am is actually just that person from the simple town. And while I might have billions of dollars in the bank, just recognizing who I am and where I come from and sort of removing all this clutter from my mind gives me the ability to pivot without, you know, carrying too much of the baggage. And to me, that felt like a low center of gravity kind of a statement when I process what you're telling me.
Yeah, yeah. And I find it's harder to do than I maybe thought. And sometimes my friends, you know, that have been super successful, they'll come to our house and we bought a house 25 years ago that we still live in. We paid cash for it 25 years ago. And it's on a nice lake and, you know, there's tennis court and everything, but nearby. And but they'll say, Lloyd, do you just have this one home? Do you just live here? And you know, you get tempted, right? To think, well, really, I probably should have a second, you know, something else. And every stage you're at in life, you're always tempted to go up. And the freedom comes when you go down.
The other piece you talk about, Lloyd, is notion of maintaining a margin across four domains: physical, emotional, financial, and spiritual. Can you expand on the notion of a margin, the way you mean it?
Yeah, you know, I think that we can't expect everything in life to go up and to the right and always be positive. We're likely to encounter some things that are really big smackdown. That are, you know, either a health problem in one of our children, or, you know, an economic downturn, or you know, a big emotional disappointment. A friend betrays us, or something like that. Somebody we serve and we think we're really helping, all of a sudden they commit suicide. And the question is, what is it going to take for me to finish well? Not just be a flash in the pan, not just have a short season where I'm making a big contribution. But, you know, if you and I sit down 30 years from now, Deepak, I want to be able to tell you I'm still in the game. I'm still making a difference in this world. And that means that I need to be prepared for when something goes wrong. I need to have some shock absorber with me. And if you just have financial margin, but you don't have physical margin or emotional or spiritual margin, you won't survive. I remember I did some events in the summer with a guy named Jim Collins.
Yes.
And he's written business books, and maybe you've interviewed him before, but he's written Good to Great and Built to Last. And
he's on my wish list.
Oh, good. Good for you. Well, we did these events in the summer in Boulder, Colorado called Finishing Great. And we would get leaders like you're on your audience. And we spent 2 days together asking the question, what will it look like for me to finish great in life and not just flame out? And so I asked him at one of those, I said to him, Jim, what are you studying and what are you learning these days? And he said, I'm studying luck. And he's since written about it. It's called Great by Choice. It's a book called Great by Choice. Mm-hmm. And he studied how businesses, how they deal with good luck and bad luck and what makes the difference. Now, he described luck as something that's unexpected, you can't control, and it's material to your business or life.
Mm-hmm.
And he found businesses have equal amounts of good luck and bad luck. But what makes the difference is if they're prepared for the bad luck and they can get back up again. So cash flow is king sometimes in your life. If you don't have any financial, if you outspend your income and you have no financial margin, if something bad happens, you could get really taken down and may not recover for a long time. If you don't have spiritual margin where your soul is being nurtured by God on a daily basis. You know, one of the most important times I spend every day is sitting here quietly in my study with my Bible, reading and for God's ancient wisdom and praying. And it nurtures my soul. And then when something frustrating happens, I'm going to react out of the nurture of that love and kindness that I got rather than just out of anger and bitterness, right? And so I need to nurture the fruit of the Spirit in my life if it's going to show up when things are stressful. And so what I try to do is to stay within my limits, is cut back on spending, cut back on commitments so that I have time, emotional energy, spiritual energy. You know, I got time this morning to go to the gym and lift weights so that I have strength. And I don't need to be strong and muscly to do this interview with you, but it does give me resilience, right?
Got it. And as you end the book, Lloyd, you say that it dawned on me that I'd set out on a journey from success to significance, only to find that significance alone could never fill the emptiness in my heart. What I was really longing for all along was satisfaction. How should people think about significance and satisfaction?
Well, I would say success is when I use what I have for me and my benefit. Significance could be when I use what I have for you, for me and others, benefits. And the satisfaction, I think, comes from this deep sense that I've used what I was given, the time I was given on this planet, the talent, the opportunity, the influence to serve others and to love extravagance. And that there's nothing else I'm craving. And that's where I seek to end each day, is with equanimity, a sense that I have no regrets. I'm not grasping. I have nothing to prove and nothing to protect. And that I've done my best to love some people extravagantly, starting with loving my God and loving my wife and loving my kids. And so now I take a morning every week to be with our two grandbabies. One is 1 year old. She's deaf and she has hearing aids. And the other's three and she's diaper changing. Now, potty changing. I mean, Deepak, can you imagine how me with one little girl with hearing aids, I'm trying not to fall out. And one little girl, I'm trying to say, now, do you need to go potty? So she doesn't have an accident. It's like, it's like watching a circus. But it's priceless. And I'm staying in it so that I get better at it, right? I don't think I'm ever going to regret that. Do you? Do you think I'll ever regret the time I spend with those girls?
Absolutely.
And so I find deep satisfaction in that. Now, my next hour might be with the CEO of a big company. But I mean, I'm not impressed by one over the other. I have the privilege to serve them. So there's deep satisfaction in that. And that's a maturing process, right? If you and I were talking 20 years from now or 30 years from now, you'd find a very different guy. I didn't have that perspective. I wish I did, but I didn't.
And I'd be the one changing the diapers maybe of my grandchildren. So, yeah. Lloyd, it's been a wonderful last hour speaking with you. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. Given your life, your journey, and your sort of experience working with leaders at the Halftime Institute and beyond, how do you think about playing to potential?
Well, you know, I just got finished watching the U.S. Open, and I realized that there were several components to these people that really that brought their best and won. First of all, they trained. You don't try to bring your best to the world. You train to bring your best to the world. And so it's not about waiting till you get prepared and then quitting your job and starting a nonprofit or something like that. It's about training. Do something. Get involved. Start. Mm-hmm. So training is a big – having a plan. You know, one of the things we do at the Halftime Institute is we help people build a robust roadmap. And it has their mission, their purpose, their metrics, their spouse's dreams, their family vision. I mean, imagine trying to lead a family with no vision statement. You would never run a business without a vision statement. And then their big action areas this year and their desired how they're going to measure it and the things they're going to do. And having a personal board of directors, for example. I've had a personal board of directors for 25 years. I wouldn't go out without it. It's so powerful to have people who you trust and love that are confidential, looking over your shoulder at your plan every single year. So to play to your fullest potential, you need to train, you need to plan, and you need people around you on the journey. The books you read and the people you surround yourself will determine who you become. And so that is what we're doing through the Halftime Institute, you know, not only in America and Europe and Australia, but, you know, even in parts of India. So it's the kind of thing that your listening audience can plug into if they want. Just go to halftime.org and they can find tools and resources there as well that will serve them. But it's about leadership and intentionality, right? Don't you believe that it's a big part of it is leadership and intentionality? And you don't just try to run a marathon, you train.
Wonderful. On that note, Lloyd, thank you so much for making the time. Great having you at the podcast.
You're so welcome, Deepak. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you enjoyed this conversation, you might also want to tune into my conversations with three of the other guests. Herminia Ibarra, author of Working Identity. Linda Grattan, author of 100 Year Life. And Bruce Feiler, author of Life is in the Transitions. All of them have a different perspective on how we manage this midlife renewal. If you're interested in receiving short 2-minute extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up once or twice a week, consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here, we share short extracts across the various guests we have at the podcast. Do also take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there. And it also makes a difference because speakers care about some of these metrics. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and some of the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. Thank you. And I hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.